We're at the very end of Hebrews chapter 8 now. We covered through verse 12 last week, so we need to read verse 13 before proceeding on to chapter 9. We'll go ahead and ask Brother Dave to read Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 13 for us.
In there you say, a new covenant he hath made the first law. Now that which he saith in wax of old is ready to vanish away.
Okay, so this statement here comes after all of that teaching that we've had, well, not just here in chapter 8, but even going back before chapter 8, when he's been, particularly chapter 7 and 8 together, when he's been teaching about Christ being high priest after the order of Melchizedek, necessitating then with a change in priesthood, that also of the law. So there had to be a change in the covenants for God's plan and purpose to be fulfilled, to bring in Christ and have him as our high priest in order to make possible the things that were not possible and not included in the law of Moses, as it was not God's plan for that to be the everlasting covenant. And so we went through all of those things where, as he's teaching here, especially in this chapter, that this covenant of Christ is a better one, based upon better promises. And then he went back to Jeremiah 31 and quoted that prophecy from verses 31 through 34 there, that is quoted in Hebrews chapter 8. And then he particularly honed in on those three aspects of the new covenant that were different from the old. And as we had mentioned last week, those are not the only three things that are different, but he's highlighting those particular ones in that prophecy, and then showing the fulfillment of it here. The first of those was the fact that the new covenant was going to be written in the inner man. The old covenant that was written on those stone tables, the new covenant would not be written on stone tables like the old. It would be written in the table of the heart. It would be written in the hearts and minds. And so by its very design, the new covenant is to be forming, changing our inner man, conforming us to be in the image of Christ. And then furthermore, along with that, number two, he mentioned how those that are under the new covenant would not have to be taught to know the Lord. And as we again mentioned last time, that doesn't mean that we're not going to learn more about the Lord, to know him better and more fully. But there is a basic knowledge of the Father and of his Son, Jesus Christ, and understanding and faith in that we have to have in order to be a Christian in the first place. Under the old covenant, they would come into that covenant, and the token of it was circumcision, which was that was something that was done on the eighth day after birth. So someone was in the covenant with the Lord at that point, not knowing anything as an infant. So they would have to learn later of the God that they were in that covenant with. Well, in the new covenant, we have to know the Lord in order to be in it. And then finally, remission of sins that would be available under the new covenant by the sacrifice of Christ. So then, with all those points made about the superiority of Christ and his priesthood, his high priesthood, and the covenant that he brought in, then what would that mean about the old one? Well, as he had started this off, if the old one did not have fault, then what would have been the point or the necessity of having a new one? Well, there would have been no reason to. And that was the point in verse 7. If the first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second? And then everything after that statement of verse 7 has been showing how there was a need for the second covenant. So since there was, then what would that say about the first one then? Well, if you needed a second one because of the fault of the first one, then when the second one is instituted, then what becomes of the first one that was inferior? It's got to vanish away and be done away. So that is, that's of course what happened. In that he saith a new covenant, he has made the first old. I mean, was the law of Moses, was it called the old covenant? Do we read that term in the Old Testament books? Did he tell Moses, come up into the mountain, I'm going to give you the old covenant? No, well, why do we call it the Old Testament? Because we have a New Testament. I mean, that's the whole reason that even has that designation, which is really what he's saying there. So the very name of it is testimony to the fact that there is a new and a better covenant, the everlasting one, the law of Christ, the gospel of Christ. So there was this old covenant, and that was made old by the institution of the new. So then that which decays and waxes old is ready to vanish away. Now it's interesting, we don't know the exact year of the writing of this book of Hebrews, but we certainly know it was written after what's the earliest this could have been written? Right, exactly. And why that date? We know it was written after what? What's that? Yeah, I mean, this obviously had to be written after Christ came and after his death and burial and resurrection and the establishment of the church. This book is written to Christians. We've seen that addressed throughout. This is obviously written. Well, he couldn't be talking about the fact that there is a new covenant in place and all that Christ is that hadn't happened yet. So he's speaking after the fact of the establishment of all of that and the establishment of the new covenant. That's a key point there. This is written to Christians. This is not written in the age of the Old Testament. Well, that being the case, why does he say that which decays and waxes old is ready to vanish away? Why doesn't he say that which decayed and grew old has vanished away? Why does he phrase it like this? Well, let's look at Colossians 2 verse 14, because this is going to require some discernment on our part based on teachings in a number of verses in the New Testament about the old. But let's read Colossians chapter 2. This is a well-known verse to us, as it should be. Verse 14, Colossians 2 verse 14. Caleb, can you read that? Okay, so he's referring to the old covenant there, those handwriting of ordinances that was against us. Now again, that is demonstrating that there was a need for a new covenant, just the way he's phrasing that. Contrary to us, and it says he took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. So what happened to the old covenant? Now in Matthew chapter 5, when Jesus was preaching the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 5, he made reference to what he was doing with that old covenant. Let's go back over there, Matthew chapter 5, keeping in mind what we just read in Colossians 2 verse 14, that says it was nailed to his cross. How could that be? Well, what had to happen in order for it to be nailed to his cross? Let's read what he said here in verses 17 through 19 of Matthew chapter 5 with a Tom.
Matthew 5:17. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments, and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven.
All right. So what did he do with the old covenant? He fulfilled it. How was it going to be taken out of the way and nailed to his cross if it had not been fulfilled? He didn't come to destroy it. He came to fulfill it. So for it to be taken out of the way and nailed to his cross, he had to fulfill all that was there. So everything that we just read in Colossians 2:14, those handwriting ordinances that he says was against us and contrary to us, well, what did it do to everyone who, and we went over this point as it's brought out in Galatians 3, what happened to everyone that was under that covenant until Christ? They all broke one of them, didn't it? That's the point of Romans chapter 3 when he's talking about Jews and Gentiles. When he gets to verse 23, he says, "For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God." Speaking of Jew and Gentile, well, the Jews certainly did. And what happened under the old covenant when they sinned and fell short of the glory of God? What did that covenant do to them? It cursed them. So Christ came to redeem them from the curse. Well, how could he redeem them from the curse if he didn't fulfill, keep that covenant? He was the only one that did and never broke one of those commandments. So he wasn't cursed by any disobedience because he did no sin. He did not transgress any of those laws. So he did fulfill that. What was the last thing that he said? We have a record of seven different things that Christ spoke after he was actually nailed to the cross. What are the first words recorded after they crucified him? That's almost the last. The first thing was that he said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do." That was the first statement that is recorded that he made. The last one was when he said, "Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit." But right before he said that, the thing before that, he said, "It is finished." It was completed. So at that point, just before his death, he was acknowledging the fact that it was all fulfilled. He had done it. And so then he gave up his life. That was the end. So he did fulfill and finished all of that. And so then it was taken out of the way, I mean, there on his cross. And so when we look at that, when we're looking at the Old Testament, we do have to keep in mind the Old Testament, the law of Moses, had a couple of different functions. There was the religious aspect of the law. It was a religious law. It dictated everything they were to practice in their religion, but it was also a law for a physical nation. I mean, it had a purpose as a civil law. This is also one reason why there were certain parts of their civil law, things that God allowed, just like we have our civil laws that we're under, and there are things that are legal by our civil laws that, though that it may be legal, it doesn't mean it's what God desires or that it's right in His sight. We can be legally right and morally wrong. And that was the case under the Old Testament too. So this was part of its design. But it was designed as a law to govern the nation. It included the civil laws. Now, did he make a distinction? Okay, here's the religious part, here's the civil part. No. What he taught them, I mean, it was, they had to keep all of it. But there is that distinction, which comes into play, even though he doesn't categorize the laws in those, well, here's this part, here's that part. Both parts are intermingled. They're there. But when we get to the New Testament with the crucifixion of Christ, with the law being nailed to his cross, we do have to recognize that there was still an aspect of that law that was in force. Now, as a religious law, at Christ's crucifixion, did it still have a function as a religious law in effect for mankind at that point? No, and the reason we know that, this was actually an issue that caused division in the churches after the Gentiles were converted. This was not an issue until that point. because of the fact that, well, it was a civil law for the Jewish nation, the physical nation of Israel. When did the Jewish nation come to an end? Now, some might say, well, there's a place over there now in that area that's called Israel, and they have a flag, and Jan's been there, and probably there's some others in here been there too, but is that what is called Israel today? Is that the Israel of the Bible? And even though, I mean, we don't have the genealogical records to go back and show the descent from Abraham to where they are, I'll take their word for it that that the Jews that still exist would probably have that, for the most part, would have that physical lineage there. But there's no proof of it. And what does it matter as far as God, how God views anyone and how he's going to work with them or judge them? Nothing. Just like whatever physical or genetics or whatever that we have ourselves. Those things are not part of Christianity and what's under Christ. So whoever Jews are today and Israel that's in existence in the Middle East at this time, those are not the Jews of the Bible. That's not the Israel of the Bible. When did that nation come into existence? The one of the Bible. When did the Israelite nation have its beginning? Now, you can trace its origins back to Abraham himself, of course, as the father of that nation, with God's promises that he made to him, and then he began the fulfillment of it when he gave him Isaac, and then Isaac was given Jacob, and then Jacob had his 12 sons that became the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel. So that was the beginning of the nation. But when did the nation actually reach the point where it was a nation? When God had fulfilled the point where, I mean, how many souls went down into Egypt? 70. Can you call 70 people a nation? No, they weren't a nation then. That was a family, and a large family and a growing family, but they were not yet a nation. But when did they become such? Well, they were given birth as a nation at the point. Well, when did God designate that? When did God say, "Tell them, okay, this is now your beginning, and you're going to even set your calendar by that"? When he brought them out of Egypt, the Exodus, when he brought them out of Egypt under Moses, that's when that was their beginning as a nation. When that the angel passed over their houses, that 10th plague, and they were set free from their bondage. Well, then they were separate from Egypt, and they were a distinct nation. And God commanded them to number their days as such. That was their beginning. Of course, then that nation was given its earthly territory, its land in Canaan. Took 40 years after wandering in the wilderness before, under Joshua, they conquered the land of Canaan, which was also promised to them. But their nationhood began at that point with the Exodus. So there was the beginning point. And then, of course, God gave them their law. I mean, they... as they left Egypt, they went to Sinai, and then, it's chapter 14 when the Red Sea got parted, and the Egyptians were pursuing them, and they were destroyed, and then there they were on the other side, and then it's chapter 20 when he gives them the Ten Commandments in the law through to Moses. So they were a nation, they were given a law, and then later they were given their land. But that was their beginning. When did that come to an end? When did that nation that had its beginning there in the book of Exodus under Moses, when did that nation, because God, that's when he made that covenant with them. They were his people. And when did that nation cease to exist? The one that's in the Middle East today is not it. The one that's over there in the Middle East today, when did it begin? 1948? Yeah, 1948. There's a lot that happened before 1948 from somewhere in the Bible. I mean, clearly that's not the one. But when did that? That's also important to recognize. A lot of these people that call themselves evangelicals today, that are conservative religious denominations compared to a lot of other denominations, they have based in the false doctrine of premillennialism. A lot of the interest that our country has in what's going on in the Middle East relates to a lot of the beliefs, religious beliefs of certain denominations tied to premillennialism, thinking that there are certain events that are going to have to take place there in the Middle East, the conversion of the Jews and then Armageddon and all this stuff, with totally misunderstanding and contradicting the teachings of the New Testament. But without going into all of that, which we have gone into all of that many times in here, but not repeating all that now. But that is a reason why a lot of people today even look at Israel in terms of the connection with the Bible. It does. If we understand what the Bible teaches, we'll know that. I mean, they're an earthly nation like a lot of other earthly nations or all the other ones we have today, but as far as any kind of a special relationship with the God of heaven, no. And there's no connection to anything that we read about Israel in the Bible. So when did that nation come to an end? Getting back to that question. 70 AD. That's exactly right. What happened in 70 AD? Destroyed, done, exactly. Those are the things that Jesus warned them about was going to happen. Matthew 24, which is also repeated in Mark chapter 13, and we see some of it in Luke, some in 17 and also in Luke 21. But Christ taught about that in great detail. But it started there in Matthew 24 when they were showing him the stones of the temple when he came in there, and this was at the ushering in his last week on the earth. But they were showing him the goodly stones of the temple. Was he impressed? What did he say about it? Yeah, that's what he foretold. They're showing him how great it looks, and he says not one of these are going to be connected. At a certain point. So when will this be? And when is your coming? When is going to be the end of the world? You know, their minds, clearly this would all go together. It's something that was going to break that temple apart and not leave any stone left on another would go along with the end of the world. But Jesus showed it didn't. But he answered all those questions in that same chapter. But when he was foretelling the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, and he warned them there were going to be signs of that. And he said when they saw the army surrounding Jerusalem, when they saw the abomination of desolation, what happened in the book of Daniel with that Seleucid king Antiochus IV, that was also going to happen, it was going to be a repeat. But that Antiochus IV had... he was a Seleucid king, which Seleucus was one of Alexander the Great's generals. After his premature death, the Greek Empire was divided into four parts, ruled by his four generals, including Seleucus. But the ones that inherited the rulership of those nations, if you look at Daniel 11, it goes into a lot of detailed prophecies about all those different rulers, the Ptolemies in Egypt, the Seleucids that were in the area of Palestine, and there's lots of prophecies about their interactions and different rulers and things they would do. But that one came along that was Antiochus IV, and he made a sacrifice of swine in the temple. So that was an abomination, of course. He was defiling it on purpose. But then there was a prophecy that was going to be in Christ's time, or after the time of Christ, after the establishment of the New Testament. You read Daniel 9, there was a prophecy that there was going to be another abomination of desolation. Jesus quoted from that prophecy and warned them. When you see that, when there's some Gentile that comes in and defiles the temple and he's got his army surrounding Jerusalem, what was his message? Get out, don't go back to your house and get anything. Get out right then and there, because that's when it was going to fall. And that's what happened. I mean, the Christians escaped that, but the unbelievers of the Jews that did not believe in Christ, they stayed in there. What ended up happening to them? Well, many of them died in there. The survivors, they left and they went to Masada and that fortress there, and they holed up there for a while. Jan, you saw that place too, didn't you? But that eventually fell to the Romans. But anyway, in 70 AD, I mean, that was it. And then they were scattered. What happened to all the genealogical records? It was, and it had to be God's will. I mean, the temple's done. The records are done. You can go back to the Old Testament time with the return of the captivity from Babylon. You can read in the book of Ezra, the first couple of chapters of that book, when it's given the names of different families. And the ones that came back that were, if they could not, if they didn't have the genealogical records to show their precise descent from Aaron, then what did that mean for them as far as being able to serve as a priest? They could not, and they were put out. They were removed from the priesthood. Only the ones. But even if they had pled, well, everybody knows who I am and who my daddy was. I mean, was that good enough? They had to have the records to prove it, and if they couldn't, they were not allowed to be priests. By that standard, if someone had a mind, and these people that believe that there's going to be, you know, the people that believe in premillennialism, those denominations I was referring to, they think that there's going to end up being another temple built. They think that Dome of the Rock is going to be the mosque that's on the Temple Mount right now. They think that's going to be destroyed, and there's going to be a rebuilding of the temple, and then the Jewish nation is going to flourish, and that they're going to become what they say that they never got to be fully in the Bible time, because they say there were still prophecies there that hadn't been fulfilled. They're wrong about that. They're plain statements in the Old Testament that all the things that God promised to Israel were fulfilled in. So that's a lie and a false doctrine. But that's what they believe. And they believe that there's going to be a new temple, and that the Jewish nation of the Old Testament is going to thrive and flourish. And then they believe that, you know, Christ is going to come, and that's going to usher in all of those events that they think are necessary, that are completely against the teachings of the Scriptures. But at any rate, that's what they think is going to happen. Well, for that to happen, if you're going to have a new temple built, well, you got to have priests. You got to have a high priest if it's going to fulfill the Old Testament commands. Well, there's a big problem with that. Well, there are a lot of problems with that. First of all, what do you think the Muslims would think about the Dome of the Rock being wiped off of the Temple Mount? Well, that's not hard to figure. But were that to happen, and then the Jews would want to build a temple there again, there's several problems. Do they have the pattern of the temple as God authorized it, what was in existence before? What if you don't have the dimensions right? How are you going to have all those things there? How are you going to have a priesthood? How are you going to have a high priest? Because by the standard of the Scriptures under the Old Testament, which Jew alive today can prove his descent from Aaron, the brother of Moses? I mean, what Jew alive today can prove descent from Abraham? What tribe are they of? Now, I mean, just by percentage, you could just get, well, most of them would have to be from Judah. That's why they're called Jews. I mean, that was the vast majority of what was left of the name. But still, nobody knows for sure, because there were survivors from other tribes. Nobody today, they wouldn't know what tribe they were from. There could be no priesthood. There could be no high priest. You can't do it. God made sure at 70 AD when all that was destroyed that it could not be redone. It was put out of existence permanently. That was the point. Christ prophesied of it. There are prophecies in the Old Testament about it. But that nation was going to be brought to an end so that he could... it was going to be close to the time of the New Testament. Now, it did happen to be, you know, you've got 30, 33 AD. There's about a 40-year lag between the crucifixion of Christ and when the nation of Israel went out of existence. During that 40 years where you have a little bit of a different, well, not just a little bit, a completely different situation than what exists now and what exists ever since 70 AD. Because you had this dual situation here for that 40 years where as a religious law, it was no longer in effect for anyone. But for the civil, as a civil law, it was still in effect for the Jews who were a nation until 70 AD. Now, am I making that up? No, and that's the reason why the wording, we can read Colossians 2:14 where he says that it was taken out of the way and nailed to the cross. So we could say, well, since it was nailed to the cross, then Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 13 should say that it had waxed old and it had vanished away. And, I mean, it was decayed and vanished away. It's already done. Well, it was in one sense as a religious law. That's the reason Colossians 2:14 says what it says. That's also the reason why in Acts chapter 15, the issue that divided the church for a while was the issue about the Gentiles when they were converted, whether they had to keep the law of Moses or not. That was the question that was being settled in Acts chapter 15. Let's read verses 1 and 2 of Acts 15, just to go back there. Brother Aaron, can you read that, Acts 15, verses 1 and 2?
Serve him who came out and then taught the brothers that except you be circumcised after the manner of Moses, you cannot be saved. And therefore, Paul marked us at those laws. Since you have been taken, they determined that all of Barnabas and certain other men would go up to Jerusalem under the apostles.
Okay, so what was the question? Was it about what the Jews had to do, or is it about what the Gentiles had to do? The Gentiles. Did the Gentiles have to keep the law of Moses to be saved? I mean, that was the question. Now, if the law of Moses was still in effect as a religious law at that point, then what would be the answer to the question? Then yes, they would have. But what's the answer to that question in Acts chapter 15? It wasn't by some vote of men. The apostles and elders there in Jerusalem, that's where they went to deal with the question. But the answer was given not by men, but by whom? Well, look at verse 28. What it says to the Gentiles. Brother Trey, can you read verse 28? In verse 29.
That he abstained from meats offered to idols and from blood, and he struggled with fornication. In which if you keep yourself, you shall move the blood from where you are.
So that was what was written to the Gentile converts to Christ. But who was the one that settled the question? Okay, so this is from heaven, not of men, the answer. So clearly, as a religious law, did the law of Moses have any bind? Was it bound to Gentile converts to Christ? No. Why not? Well, it was taken out of the way. Jesus fulfilled it, and it was taken out of the way, nailed to the cross. So for a 40-year period, though, it does leave the issue of, well, what about the Jews as their civil law, as a nation, those who were Jews, until their nation came to an end in 70 A.D.? We had a... you had a four-decade period where, yes, it did have, it still had validity, it still had authority for them because they were Jews. And we see this this come up several times. One of the prominent ones was when they brought Jesus before Pilate. Pilate was a Roman. What was the Roman? This, you can go back to Daniel 2 and look at the prophecies there that give details of the manner in which the Romans were going to rule. That fourth kingdom that was in the vision that God gave to the prophet Daniel in chapter 2 of the book of Daniel, that image that had four parts, the legs were of iron and the feet were of partly of iron and partly of clay. And then what did he say about the, well, the Roman Empire was going to be strong as iron, but they were going to be mixed with the people and it was going to be partly strong and partly broken. And that references the manner in which the Romans ruled. And when the Romans conquered a land, they would have their people there to keep order. So as long as there was order, and as long as they paid their taxes to the Romans, then the Roman policy, it was very different than what the Greeks did. The Greeks had a policy to try to, well, the term was Hellenize, the peoples that they ruled over. They wanted to spread Greek culture, make them Greeks. Well, the Romans weren't trying to Romanize all of the people they conquered. As far as language, customs, laws, and all those things, they would let them continue their customs, continue their nations under their own laws, as long as they were orderly and paying taxes. I mean, that was pretty much the Roman policy. And that also was in effect in Israel. So Israel was still allowed to have a nation. That's why the Romans allowed them to have their puppet ruler, the Herods, in Christ's time. They were ruled still by their law, which was the Old Testament law that they went by. That's why they still had a high priest. All of those things are still in effect. Even after Christ's crucifixion. But at the time when they were crucifying Christ, they brought him before Pilate. Remember what Pilate said to them when the Jewish leaders brought him to them? John 18, let's read 28 to 32 with Samuel. John chapter 18, verses 28 to 32. And this demonstrates and shows what the Roman system was for the Jewish nation at that time. So here was Pilate, the Roman governor in Jerusalem, was reminding them of the system that they were under. So here they're bringing a Jew before him that with accusations that dealt with their law. So what did he tell them to do? Here's the Roman ruler in that area at that time stating that their law was in effect for them. For judging these things. That was a very hands-off policy. But of course, they wanted him crucified, that was something that they were not allowed to do under Roman rule. That would have been disorderly if they start going around crucifying people without the Romans agreeing with it. So that's why they were trying to get the Romans involved, so that they could get the outcome they desired. So they were really... hypocrites, but they were giving up they were yielding what little autonomy or independence they had to try to give what they wanted done to Christ. But there's Pilate acknowledging the fact that their law was enforced for them in Israel. Now, was that only true of the Jews that were in Israel proper? That also applied to Jews that were in all the other areas of the Roman Empire. Let's turn to Acts chapter 18. This is in the city of Corinth. This is in Achaia. which is over in the area that we call Greece today. This is quite some distance from Israel. This is not in Israel. This is Achaia, the city of Corinth. And here they bring Paul before the Roman deputy, Gallio, that was there then, and they're wanting Paul dealt with. Well, what does he say to them? Let's read Acts 18, 12 to 16. See, Brother Jan, can you read that?
When Gallio, the deputy of Achaia, the Jews made insurrection of one accord against Paul and brought him to the judgment seat, saying, "This fellow persuaded men to worship God contrary to the law." When Paul was now about to open his mouth, Gallio said unto the Jews, "If it were a matter of law or wicked lewdness, O Jews, reason would that I should bear with you. But if it be a question of words and names of your law, look ye to it, for I will be no judge in such matters." And he dragged him from the judgment seat.
Now, is that clear or not? So here's another Roman deputy that is stating very clearly that for the Jews, their law, the Jewish law, the law of Moses, was what they were governed by. And they didn't want to be bothered by those issues. Just pay your taxes and keep yourselves orderly. They didn't want to interfere and have to deal with those kinds of issues. So that's what they were under. And so you can see the Roman policy was for Jews. That was the law that would govern them, not just in Israel, but wherever they were in their empire. Now this issue comes up in chapter 21. In Acts chapter 21, this became what we saw in Acts 15 a while ago with that question: do the Gentiles who are converted to Christ, are they required to keep the law of Moses? Well, we could see what the Holy Spirit determined there in Acts chapter 15. And for Gentiles, they were not brought under the law of Moses. In fact, go to books like Galatians, especially chapter 5, 1 through 4. We looked at that recently. But those who do put themselves under the law of Moses will sever themselves from Christ and fall from grace. So it's not just a neutral thing about whether you want to do that. That is not to be done. So it was wrong to teach that the Gentiles had to keep the law of Moses to be saved. And it would cause them to be lost if they did that. So that was a very important issue. But when Paul was converting Gentiles, what was he telling them about the law of Moses? Was he telling them to keep it or not? Not. But was Paul telling Jews, and here this is before 70 AD, was he going around telling Jews, you don't have to keep the law of Moses? No, it was very clear the distinction. Gentiles, and this is who this would be at this time before 70 AD, Gentiles weren't under it because as a religious law it was done. Only Jews until 70 AD were under that law for their civil law. Paul kept it and he expected other Jews to keep it. And he didn't teach any of them not to. But the false accusation came up because they hated Paul as he was converting all these Gentiles. So then they were accusing Paul of telling Jews not to keep the law of Moses. And that's the issue that comes up here in Acts 21. And the elders at Jerusalem instructed Paul to make a public demonstration that would show the falsehood of that accusation. Let's read from Acts 21, verses 17 through 25. I'll go ahead and read that. I have that right here. Acts 21, 17 through 25. And when we were come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. And the day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present. And when he had saluted them, he declared particularly what things God had wrought among the Gentiles by his ministry. And when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said unto him, "Thou seest, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe, and they are all zealous of the law. And they are informed of thee that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the customs. What is it therefore? The multitude must needs come together, for they will hear that thou art come. Do therefore this that we say to thee. We have four men which have a vow on them. Them take, and purify thyself with them, and be at charges with them, that they shave their heads, that all men may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing, but that thou thyself also walkest orderly and keepest the law. As touching the Gentiles which believe, we have written and concluded that they observe no such thing, save only that they keep themselves from things offered to idols and from blood and from strangled and from fornication. Is there a distinction here between Jews and Gentiles at this point in time as to whether they were, whether the law of Moses had any authority over them? Very clearly so. Paul, these elders and all the other Jews who were converts to Christ were still to keep the law of Moses. Why? Not because it wasn't taken out of the way and nailed to the cross. Not because it wasn't fulfilled by Christ. But it was because they were still a nation and that was the law that they were under. They had to keep the law of the land. We have to keep the law of the land today that we're under. It just so happened that that law for them was the law of Moses for that period of time. But after 70 AD, when the nation ended, whether Jew or Gentile at that point, what authority would be in the law of Moses for anyone? Gone. So it was just, we just have to recognize there was this 40-year period of time where there was an effect, there was the law in effect for Jews because that was what they were under for their national or civil law. All right, so that would also explain the wording there in Hebrews 8. I mean, it was ready to vanish away. It already had vanished away as a religious law, and for any Gentiles, it was not in effect. And it was, at this point, this was not far from 70 AD when that remnant of its effect as a civil law for the nation of Israel was going to be done away. So it was ready to vanish away in all respects, very close to the time of the writing of the book of Hebrews. So that's that can help us to understand the wording that's there in that particular verse. All right. So that does tell us, though, at that point, from then on, and for us today, what is the law of Moses for us? Well, it's something for us to learn from. We need to study not just the laws, but all the books of the Old Testament. We're told to do that. We need that. We need to learn more of God from that. And those scriptures are able to make us wise in the salvation that comes by faith in Christ Jesus. That's the statement that we have in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 16. Verse 15, rather. And then verse 16 says, all scripture is given by inspiration of God. So we need to study all of it and know all of it. But as far as a law for us to observe today, what are we under? We're under the law of Christ. He has all authority in heaven and earth. We're not under any other law. Galatians 5, 1 through 4 tells us very explicitly, and that's not the only place it says that we have that command, but don't follow the law of Moses. We cannot observe that as our religious law. We're going to be cut off from Christ because we'll be brought under the curse that he redeemed us from. Colossians 2, right after that, verse 14 that we read a while ago, when it says that handwriting of ordinances that was against us and contrary to us, he's taken out of the way, nailing it to his cross. I mean, two verses down from there, he says not to let anyone judge us in those after those holy days and Sabbaths. Those new moons and all that. So those things that were in that law for us, we're not to be under that. So what about Sabbath? What about tithing? What about instrumental music? And there are a lot of those issues that people bring up and will use to try to justify things that they're doing today. You'll hear people talk about the Christian Sabbath. That's a contradiction in terms. For Christians, what is the day that the Lord has reserved for us to do certain things, to have religious observances as followers of Christ? The first day of the week, the Lord's Day, which is the day he was resurrected. That's Sunday, as we call it. But the Sabbath day was Saturday, by definition. Different day. And we're not, the laws that governed the Israelites for their seventh day under the law of Moses are not in effect for us today as Christians. So we don't have laws about any of those particular those matters. If we follow that, I mean, Colossians 2:16 explicitly mentions the Sabbath. That's the one commandment of the Ten Commandments that we're not under in any respect. Almost all of them he repeats verbatim in the New Testament. Thou shalt not take the Lord's name in vain is taught in principle and in other ways. Most of them we have exactly word for word as they were in the Ten Commandments. The only one we don't have at all is the Sabbath. Yet we'll have, you'll hear it all the time that different people will refer to observances, even talking about on Sunday as the Sabbath of the Christian Sabbath. I hear that term. It's like fingernails on a chalkboard whenever I hear that, but it's wrong. And if we do that, if we put ourselves under that, then we have a duty to do the whole thing. And then that's it. Then we're done as far as Christ profiting us. Tithing. You'll hear people talk about giving their tithes. Well, we have the plates up here. Do we give tithes in those plates on the first day of the week? Are we ever... Is the word tithe ever mentioned in the New Testament? Other than, okay, somebody's going to be technical. Matthew 23, when he talks about the Jews and how they paid tithe of mint and anise coming and left out the... Yeah, you're going to do orange tongue. And they left out the weightier matters. The law was still in effect then. But as far as the New Testament, after the Old Testament was done, do we have anything for the church about tithing? Well, of course not. I mean, there's no purpose to that. Why did he have that number for 10%? And it wasn't just 10% of the cash on hand, and it wasn't just 10% of their gross or net income. I mean, it was 10% of all their possessions. So it was 10% of their crops. It was 10% of whatever they had. They had to give a tenth of all. So even people today that try to, that will claim their tithe, they don't tithe. But why was that ever a law anyway? What did the Jews do with their tithes? Yeah, all that food and everything, that was to support the tribe of Levi because they didn't have a land inheritance. The Lord was their inheritance. So you had 12 tribes. One of them, they didn't have the means to produce for themselves and provide for themselves their sustenance like the other one. So you had the other 11 tribes giving 10%. So what happens if you have 11 tribes giving 10%? Well, then you've got that one tribe is going to have what it needs. And then you read the book of Nehemiah when they weren't doing it. Who suffered? Those Levites did. They were having to leave off the work of the Lord to go make sure they could grow food so they could live. Well, the Lord wanted them to be involved in His work full time. So that meant they had to give, all the other tribes had to give a percentage that put together would adequately provide for the support, not just financially, but with food and everything for the tribe of Levi. So there was a reason they had tithes. They had a very specific and practical reason. Well, we don't have that. We're the spiritual nation of Israel. We're not divided up into 12 physical tribes and have one tribe reserved for that work. So there's no point to having tithing. There's a reason it doesn't mention that. But if somebody's going to try to observe tithing today, then what are they duty-bound to do then? Keep the whole law. How have you ever heard anybody justify the use of mechanical instruments in music and worship in the church by saying, well, they used it in the Old Testament? Yeah, and you can go back there and look at 2 Chronicles 29:29. It was commanded. That was one of their commandments. They have a lot of commandments. Well, the fact that it was commanded in the Old Testament mean it's a commandment for us to follow? Only if it's repeated in the New Testament. Is it? No, it's not. I mean, how many of these people that will try to, they want to have, and I don't even read about a piano in the Old Testament anyway, but, you know, they had the harps and trumpets and things like that, but I'll say I've never seen, I remember when I was a kid and we were renting a facility while we were building the building that became Windsor Lake, but when we were moving out, there was some other group that was coming in to rent it, and they started moving their stuff in. I mean, the drums and guitars and all this kind of, I mean, it was, you know, I'd never seen anything like that before. But anyway, all that stuff started getting moved in. But I didn't see a harp or a rack of trumpets or anything like that. I mean, nobody uses the ones they actually did use back then. But you'll hear people say, try to use, they used instruments of music then, so that's justification to use it now. How many people that do that have an altar and have somebody to kill the sacrifices that are brought in? The animals, I mean. Do any of them, are they bringing sheep in there? And I know some people bring snakes in, but that's something different. I mean, they don't kill them and eat them right there. Do people have animal sacrifices? How about burning incense and or whatever? How many of the religious observances from the law of Moses do you see people trying to bring in today? But if you're going to bring in, you say, well, I'm going to have instrumental music because it was there, then, I mean, what are you supposed to do? And then you do have that problem we mentioned. You can't follow it today because you can't have priests because we don't have anybody with the proof of their genealogy back to Aaron. So, anyway, doing that will cut us off from Christ. We can't go back to the Old Testament and put ourselves under any of those laws. The only ones of those laws that we're under are the ones that he brings over and teaches and makes part of the new. The rest of it's vanished away for us. It does not have authority over us. There's one authority. And that's also the reason why when Peter, in his understanding, when Jesus was on the mount, when he was transfigured, and he proposed making three tabernacles Moses and Elijah appeared there. So he was going to make three tabernacles, one for Moses, one for Elijah, and one for Christ. And the voice came from heaven. No, even though for a Jew to put Christ on a plane with Moses and Elijah would be a great honor, making Christ equivalent to them, but he's not. That was what Peter's idea there was not followed. What did the voice from the Father from heaven say? This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Hear ye him. What about Moses and Elijah? Not anymore. There's one authority. He has all authority in heaven and on earth. So that's the only authority we're under today. All right, I know that there's a lot to that, but this is part of rightly dividing the word of truth to understand those issues. And there's a lot of confusion on them today. So we need to be able to answer those questions that come up. We also need that for our own defense so we don't get misled or confused on issues like that. Lord willing, next week we will get started into Hebrews chapter 9. Because he's going to get into some of the particulars of the laws and that were in effect for the Jews, and then teach about Christ and the new covenant based upon that. So we have a lot of good things to study yet in the coming chapter, Lord.